Welcome to the No Fungi, No Future podcast. In these episodes, we interview experts in the field to gain a deeper understanding of the magical and mysterious networks of mycelia that are all around us, to learn how they impact our lives and the planet. In this episode, we have the first part of our interview with Germaine Yong. Germaine is lead scientist at Amelie, a company building Southeast Asia's largest multi-ethnic gut microbiome database. In this episode, we talk about Germaine's career in studying microbes and some of the interesting things that she has learned during this journey. Thank you, Germaine, for doing this interview with us. In the beginning, I was wondering if we could talk a little bit about your career journey and what was it that led you to studying the microbiome and some of the related areas that are of interest to you?
So I would say that my career journey really has always revolved around microbes in some shape or form. Mm-hmm. At the very beginning, even before I had gone to college, I had already been interested in microbes. And back then, I actually had like a little side project while I was in school that looked at the effect of a common household disinfectant that you might be familiar with since you mentioned that you grew up in Singapore. Mm-hmm. It's called Dentamol.
Yes.
I was very interested back then in how basically Dentamol was commonly used in households, but really there was a lot of talk back then about antibiotic resistance in like the medical field, but uh-huh. At that point really had started looking at antimicrobial resistance in homes. So that was really sort of what got me interested in microbes in the first place. But then if I fast forward that journey through to college and beyond, really I dabbled in looking at microbes in various ecosystems, ranging from food to the marine ecosystem, mm-hmm. and oceans. And of course, naturally, very much in the health and disease space.
Right.
And then that really sort of catalyzed my interest in understanding microbes better.
Uh-huh.
And it became very clear that microbes don't exist singly in isolation, but in communities.
Yeah.
And that really was what inspired me to then pursue my graduate studies in the field of microbiome science.
Uh-huh.
And that was when I really took a deep dive and started looking into microbial communities. And it first started out actually in babies,
mm-hmm.
where I started understanding how that process of microbial colonization during mm-hmm. the first year of life
mm-hmm.
actually has legacy effects on metabolic programming in infants
mm-hmm.
And its consequences in child obesity. So that sort of where I had been previously.
Yeah.
And then subsequently, I would say over the past 5.5 years since leaving grad school,
uh-huh.
That's when I've really taken that pivot into understanding the role of microbes in our gut and its relationship with food, actually.
Okay. Uh-huh.
And that really stems from me, I think, being a Singaporean.
Okay.
I think all Singaporeans love food.
Mm-hmm.
Naturally, really trying to bring together that interest and passion for food with my professional day job was what brought me into the field of like diet microbiome interactions as being really my area of specialization in study.
Uh-huh.
So I would say that sort of really has been the focus of what I've been looking at scientifically for the past 5.5 years. I've done that both here at Amelie for 2 years now.
Mm-hmm.
And before that, I was also looking at it in one of the Singapore research institutions,
mm-hmm.
which is, that was a public academic institution called
Okay.
Yeah. So,
A quick question. When you even went at a young age, when you were looking at Dettol, what did you find?
We found, I guess to me back then it was surprising,
uh-huh.
but now in hindsight, I was like, I guess that's not surprising at all. But we found it was really a very simple experiment back then, because mm-hmm. naturally being, you know, in middle high school, like there's only that level of sophistication, right, that your experiments can be.
Yeah.
But we basically asked the question of if people are using or adding Dettol to their cleaning, to the water that they use to like mop their floors and clean their surfaces,
mm-hmm.
and they're doing it on a daily basis.
Mm-hmm.
One thing that we knew was that many households, number one, did not follow the recommended dilutions,
mm-hmm.
that they added less than what was required, right?
Uh-huh.
And if you draw that concept back to antibiotic resistance in healthcare, it's equivalent to not finishing your course.
Yes, yeah, right.
So what we found is that if you actually dose,
uh-huh.
Or use Dettol in the home,
yeah,
and you actually don't need the recommended exposure duration or concentration.
Yeah.
You very quickly actually promote resistance among common microbes that are living on your household surface.
My gosh.
So you're not actually doing a good job at disinfecting.
Right.
It's really boiling down to that concept of what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. The same thing applied to microbes means that you're essentially promoting resistance to antimicrobials in your very home.
Yeah.
And that for a typical healthy human being probably is not that should I put it? Doesn't bear as serious consequences, but you can imagine if it's a household where there are immunocompromised individuals,
yeah.
For example, elderly or very young children and
yeah.
babies, that can actually be a cause for concern. And
yeah.
I would say since that project was done, I'm revealing my age now, but if I backtrack, since that work was done, oh my gosh, 20 years ago, right? Really the field of antimicrobial resistance has gained a lot more traction.
Yeah.
And I think antimicrobial resistance in households is also now a known
yeah.
phenomenon that healthcare professionals are paying attention to.
Yeah. Thank you. And also, as you were doing some of your other studies, are there any things that really jumped out as you as interesting findings or things that struck you as surprising?
I would say microbes are, even though they're invisible to the naked eye,
mm-hmm.
What has really, I think, kept my passion, and this goes back to what has struck me,
mm-hmm. yeah,
they're incredibly resilient and adaptable.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what has really struck me is how quickly they actually respond to the environment and can actually either hunker down
mm-hmm.
and sort of hang out
yeah.
As compared to when the environmental conditions are right, they can essentially really thrive in very rapidly reproducible manners of time.
Yeah.
So I think that's something that has always struck me. They're incredibly resistant, resilient. I think that's exactly why I'm so attracted to studying microbes and vectors in our daily lives.
Yeah. And another question I have is, you know, when microbiome experts, they often talk about good gut bacteria and bad gut bacteria. And I'm wondering, how do they know which is good, which is bad? Is there too much of a good thing? You know, what's the way, what are your thoughts on those common terms that people throw around?
Sure. I feel like the term good and bad gut bacteria. So let's start with the lowest hanging fruit.
Okay.
Say bad gut bacteria. Typically, so I'll go with the ones that are easier to sort of work, like they really fall squarely black and white into
mm-hmm.
good and bad.
Mm-hmm.
Naturally, you know, if you're thinking about pathogens,
mm-hmm.
whereby, you know, any amount of that particular microbe would actually make you sick, that's
mm-hmm.
clearly a bad bacteria, right? And
okay.
those are the ones that you're associated with, like, for example, food poisoning.
Uh-huh.
And the ones where I would say, you know, are typically classically good, many of those, I think, are what many layman consumers in the market would assume are good bacteria. They're the ones that are typically responsible for fermenting foods into
okay.
fermented foods.
Okay.
Typically, those microbes, no matter how large the dose is, maybe, for example, yogurt has a ton of probiotic
right.
bacteria in it.
Right.
So no matter what the dose is, there isn't sort of like a dose response curve whereby too much of it actually results necessarily in a profound harmful physiological effect.
Mm-hmm.
I think the area gets a lot more gray when mm. you're looking at microbes that are commonly found in the gut, but whether they're actually good or bad for your health depends on their ecological context. And that's
yeah.
where, you know, the term, for example, opportunistic pathogens arise.
Right.
For example, the common misconception is that E. coli is always bad for you.
Uh-huh.
But the truth is E. coli actually is present in everyone's gut.
Yeah.
And it's really a question of which strains
uh-huh.
are present.
Yeah.
Different strains. There are strains that are outright bad for you. No matter how little of it, that particular strain
yeah.
is going to make you sick.
Yeah.
But there are actually many E. coli that are regular residents in the gut, what we call commensals.
Mm-hmm.
And those specific strains of E. coli, they are what sometimes can eventually pan out to be an opportunistic pathogen, whereby in a healthy individual, they are usually they create a there's a lack of any harmful symptoms.
Right.
They basically result in asymptomatic individuals.
Yeah.
But then let's say that particular individual who's harboring those E. coli has a decrease in immune responses or immune integrity.
Yeah.
Then those E. coli, for example, may then cause the individual to fall sick depending on certain, for example, they may be more able to cross the gut barrier and
yeah.
cause infection. And
yeah.
Yeah.
Great. Thank you for that.
We hope you enjoyed this episode featuring our conversation with Jermaine Yong. Be sure to look out for our next episode coming out soon, where we will continue this conversation. Until then, be sure to get some healthy mushrooms into your diet. Also, please take a moment to like and subscribe to our channel and drop us any comments. Your feedback is most welcome. Thanks for listening.